Ford stock jumping in the pre-market, and that's after the now electric vehicle maker has announced that they are doubling the production target for the electric F-150 Lightning by mid-2023 to 150,000 vehicles, and that's up from 40,000. Originally, you can see the stock's up about 3.25% in your TV and your screen right there. I just want to bring in Kumar Galhotra. He is a Ford president of the Americas and international markets. And Kumar, there's some excitement and some buzz around here. How deep is the penetration into the core U.S. markets for this truck?
Oh, it is incredible. As you mentioned, we started taking reservations after we revealed the vehicle, and the reservations kept coming in, and we started working on increasing capacity. In August, we announced it would be up to 80,000 Lightnings. And the demand still was very, very robust. So it's very exciting today to announce that we are taking the capacity up to 150,000 Lightnings per year. And we will do that sometime in the middle of 2023.
Kumar, it's Julie here. That increase in capacity implies not just that you're seeing demand, but obviously that you also feel you can increase capacity, which has not been a given over the past couple of years because of various kinds of shortages. So it sounds like it's going to take you a while to ramp up that production. But where do you stand with supply chain? Are you getting chips in and other types of parts that you need in order to make these vehicles?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because the twin crises of the COVID, which then caused the chip crisis, and the two of them keep sort of intersecting with each other at all points, has been quite a challenge for about last 18 months. We expect the chip crisis to spill into 2022, maybe a bit into 23 as well, but we are doing everything. We have several levers that we're pulling. We have a team of engineers that are constantly working to design around the chip crisis so that we can get more flexibility on which chips are used where. We are working up, obviously, with our supply chain. We have this memo of understanding with GlobalFoundry. So all kinds of work happening to mitigate the chip crisis. But today's announcement is slightly different because we are building a new factory. I'm coming to you from Rouge Electric Vehicle Center, which is part of our very iconic Rouge Industrial Complex, where we're going to build the F-150 Lightnings. For increasing the F-150 Lightning capacity, obviously, we need to bring in all the parts that are necessary to build a vehicle, the most important of which are batteries. We've been working with our battery supplier partners to increase battery capacity. And the motor capacity and the inverter capacity, all of those, some of them are within our supply chain, some are with supplier partners. So we're working with all of them, and we're highly confident that we can increase 250,000 Lightnings sometime in 2023, a run rate of 150,000 per year.
And Kumar, just thinking about the broader EV adoption trends that we've been seeing, just let me give you an example. I was in Texas late last year, and people down there love their Ford and other pickup trucks, but they're internal combustion engine trucks. And I'm just wondering, when this finally rolls out in a big way, do you see the pre-orders that this is really penetrating some of those core ICE markets that have traditionally belonged to that specific type of truck?
Absolutely, because it all comes down to is capability. You know, truck buyers are all about capability and versatility. And by capability, I mean, first and foremost, built for tough. F-150, the gas version, has had a reputation for and delivers on capability like no other pickup does. We've been the market leaders for over 40 years. And all of those customers truly understand the capability the Lightning will bring. It can can tow more than 10,000 pounds, more than 2,000 pounds of payload, and most importantly, it goes through all the same testing for durability and toughness that our internal combustion engines go through, internal combustion F-150s go through. So there's that part of the customer base. But what is even more interesting is the customers that are coming into the Ford brand that haven't owned Ford in a very long time. We saw that with Mustang Mach-E, and we are seeing that again with F-150 Lightning. More than 75% of our reservations for F-150 Lightning are from folks who haven't owned a Ford in a while. So that is pure growth for our brand. And it just demonstrates, you know, if you deliver a compelling battery electric product, there's a whole different market out there that's willing to give you a chance.
This is really interesting, that sort of combination of conversion and also new customers. Kumar, I would ask you to how you feel the Lightning sizes up against what is now going to be an increasingly competitive market. Obviously, you have Rivian. At some point, you're going to have the Cybertruck, I guess, and other entrants into the market. You know, I know it's very early days, but what are your kind of projections for market share here? What role is Ford going to play in this market?
Well, I would start with our record. The F-Series has been not only best-selling truck, but best-selling vehicle in the United States for 40-plus years. So that just shows, the kind of iconic product F-Series is. And we've been winning in that marketplace for decades. We plan to continue to win. And it all comes down to is understanding the customers and understanding them really, really well. We have a long-standing relationship with pickup customers. We understand them well. We understand their needs well. We also anticipate their needs sometimes they don't know about. So you put all that together with a very compelling starting price of $39,974 is what's driven this demand. And the fact that we have over 200,000 reservations, the fact that the reservations were coming in at a pace that we actually had to pause taking reservations, I think says those numbers speak for themselves. And look, competition is always great. We love competition. It makes us all better. And competition, especially in this segment, is better for the world. It's lower CO2 footprint. And we look forward to competing with all the companies that you mentioned. But we plan on winning, and we have a record that says that we will win in this segment.
All right. We have to leave it there, but really appreciate you stopping by and sharing that with us. Kumar Galhotra, Ford President of the Americas and International Market.
Let's bring in the head of New York's largest healthcare provider. We've got Michael Dowling joining us. He is the CEO of Northwell Health. And Michael, we've heard so many of these stories across the country, but give me a sense of what's happening in your hospitals. How are you coping sort of with this 1-2 punch on the one hand, getting more and more patients through the door, but also with your staff having to deal with these infections?
Yeah, we're doing quite well. I mean, it is very manageable. Sometimes people think that it's very crazy. And of course, it's somewhat difficult because you are in the middle of a pandemic, but it is quite manageable. We're staying very, very calm. And there is some very, very good news that I think is worth noticing. One is that while our numbers have increased, today I have 1,570 COVID cases. That's a big increase over about 2 weeks ago, but it seems to be flattening a little bit over the last couple of days. But the good news is that people are not as sick as they were before. The percentage of people in the ICUs is basically staying very low and flat. And the numbers of people being intubated is very, very low. And this is completely an improved circumstance from what it was a year and a half ago. So you've got to put this whole thing in perspective. On the staff issue, we are managing. It is a little bit stressful, and I have been walking the floors of each of the hospitals. And when you do that, you find that staff are a little bit tired, but they're committed, and there is no crisis here. I do have about 2,500 staff out at the moment, but keep in mind that I have about 78,000 people. So, 2,500 is, 2% of my overall staff. So, and we're a big health system, so I can move staff around. So the bottom line is, it is quite manageable. It is not crazy. I do think that we will have another 2 weeks of this. And then I think it's going to slow down quite a bit. We may be close to the peak right now.
And Michael, too, I mean, when we talk about, some of the issues that got us here in terms of exploding cases, obviously not good in terms of the backlog of tests and the inability for a lot of people out there to get tests. I mean, it's not as if it was a surprise that we might be dealing with a lot of issues around COVID heading into the holidays. Talk to me about maybe what some of those frustrations look like, maybe frustrations you're hearing from staff that are burned out in the way that maybe some of that was fumbled leading up to this last surge.
Well, first of all, with my staff, I required all staff to be vaccinated. I was one of the first out of the box to do this way back. So every single one of my staff are vaccinated. Not everybody has got the booster yet, but we're working on that diligently right now because you're not fully vaccinated until you do get the booster, in my view. So from a staff point of view and vaccination, everybody is vaccinated. Now, I did lose some staff because of that, because they made a decision that they were not going to comply with a requirement of employment. And so that has helped me. I do hire about 250 new staff a week. That number is increasing, in fact, each week. So I don't have a problem getting new staff to join. On the testing side, now, the more testing you do, obviously, the more positivity you will have. That's an automatic outcome of doing more testing. And we probably should have been more prepared with more sites for testing. We've opened up quite a number. This is an unbelievably highly transmissible virus, and that may have caught us off guard a little bit. But, you know, we can always argue that we should have been a little bit more prepared overall nationally on this. But we have a lot of testing sites, and they're working quite well at the moment. So, and by the way, one last point I want to make is that The more people are positive, the more herd immunity you're going to have. So when everybody gets positive, you have immunity. You have community immunity, which is not a bad thing. I focus mostly on the hospitalization numbers, not necessarily what goes on in the community. Mm-hmm. The long lines are an inconvenience, but I focus on the hospital side. And the hospital side is not as bad at all as it was a year ago, and nothing like what we did 2 years ago.
Michael, going back to what you just said about your staffing, how many workers have you actually lost because of failure to comply with the vaccine mandate? Do you have a number? What percentage?
I lost about 1.5%. I lost close to 1,800 employees because we did give medical exemptions, but that were the only exemptions we gave because I believe very, very firmly that if you're going to be treating patients in any one of our facilities, you have to be vaccinated. I don't want unvaccinated people serving the public. I don't think it's appropriate. Now, I know this has been a problem in other parts of the country, and of course, it's very political. There's lots of debates about it. And I've been under a lot of criticism in part because of what we did, but I accept that criticism because it was the right thing to do. If you're working in healthcare and you're taking care of patients, you should be vaccinated. No excuses.
Michael Dowling, Northwell Health CEO. We always appreciate having you on the show. Thanks so much for making the time today. Well, Tesla is just the latest American company facing backlash for doing business in China's Xinjiang region. Activists accusing the EV maker now of providing economic support for genocide after it opened a showroom in the very region where the Biden administration has accused China of committing human rights abuses. The outrage comes just weeks after the president signed a bill that bans imports from the region to address concerns about forced labor. Let's bring in the senator who co-sponsored that bill. We've got Senator Jeff Merkley joining us from Oregon. Senator, it's great to have you on. Certainly a lot to get through to on the issue of China. I'd love to start on the issue of Tesla, though, because we have seen a number of Western brands already, Intel as well as Walmart, face pushback domestically because now they have to be in compliance with this law that bans imports. Tesla's argument could be that, look, we're not using forced labor, but I wonder if you think they should be doing business in Xinjiang.
So it's really important that we we draw world attention to what's going on in Xinjiang, because we're talking about genocide, not just an accusation by this administration. It is the result of a thorough effort by the State Department under the Trump administration, followed by a thorough review by the Biden administration. And the list of things that are done to the Uyghur population, they're a Muslim population inside China, is just horrific. We're talking about cultural genocide, but we're also talking about strategies to prevent the reproduction, that is to prevent them from having children, separation of children from families, forced sterilizations, and we're talking about slavery, slavery of some million individuals. So when a company decides to place its enterprise in the middle of this setting of genocide and slavery, it is really doing something very unethical. It is basically saying these things don't matter. We want the income from operating in one more region. And I would say to the president of Marriott, who dodged your question when she talked, when you raised the question to her twice, they are making a choice. They are also, like Tesla, making a choice to have Marriott Enterprises, whether owned directly or indirectly, they're under the Marriott name, in the middle of this massive, worst on the globe human rights violations. So I think companies should steer very clear of having enterprises, even if they are not producing stuff, just locating an outlet in Xinjiang gives cover to the Chinese government.
Let's talk about this specific law that has now been signed, the Uyghur Forced Prevention Labor Act. How are you looking at how this addresses the issue of human rights abuses? Some would argue it's great to ban imports from the region, but at the end of the day, it's Beijing that's setting the rules. If companies are still allowed to operate there, isn't that just being complicit with what Beijing is carrying out in the region?
Well, the products of forced labor, products of slavery, should not be ones we allow into our country. And part of the reason the cost is so low for these products is because they're produced with slave labor. So we cannot be complicit in that slavery by buying those products. So that's a very clear human rights line. The issue reverberates particularly now in the context of the upcoming Olympics. This broader Chinese context, because the International Olympic Committee chose to keep the Olympics in China, in Beijing, even as China engaged in one, accelerating the intensity of their devastation of the Uyghur population, and stripped outright the political rights of the citizens of Hong Kong, violating the agreement that China had made with Hong Kong. And it puts the athletes in the position of essentially helping put glitz and glamour of the Olympics to cover up what China is doing. And so it's a time to also focus on the sponsors of the Olympics, the diplomats. I've called for diplomatic boycott. I'm very glad the United States has decided to do so. I applaud the Biden administration. I applaud the United Kingdom. I applaud Australia. But where is the rest of the free world? They need to join in dramatizing this so China knows it doesn't get a free pass.
Yeah. Senator, I mean, when shifting just, you know, to another big global story here, as we've been watching it play out over the last few weeks with the Omicron surge, has been kind of the unequal distribution of vaccines around the globe and perhaps some of the issues around what that could mean for the next variant here. We're hearing maybe more push from those in the medical community to really have other countries step up and make sure those in less prosperous countries are vaccinated. What more do you think should be done on that front to make sure we do get vaccines out to maybe those citizens around the globe?
Yes, well, one of the things we need to do is follow the advice of the World Health Organization and establish production centers around the globe that in the context of both this vaccine and in the context of future infections can rapidly ramp up production because that global production capacity is going, we're going to need it sooner or later. We had MERS, we had SARS, well, we have COVID, now we have mutations of COVID, and fast vaccination of the rest of the world greatly decreases the source of new mutations that come back to afflict us. Look at the devastation we're facing right now with this variant, this Omicron variant is affecting everything we do. The airlines can't run all their flights. The cafeteria can't deliver their food. Restaurants are starting to see a decline in customers as people gain more concern about the highly contagious nature of this mutation. And so world production capacity, we have a stake in that. Yes, we should help sell and convey vaccines to the world, but we should also help the group of international nations build production capacity to address both this, future mutations, and then future and different viruses that might come along.
Senator, we've got the Washington Post reporting that both parties are now considering a targeted relief package in light of this latest disruption we're seeing from the Omicron surge. What kind of stimulus do you think should be set aside, especially for restaurants and small businesses who are no longer getting that aid that they got early on in the pandemic?
You bet. So right now we're trying to analyze how much impact has occurred as a result of this latest wave and respond accordingly. We went through many different packages, PPP, which now we have talked about, BBB, Build Back Better, but before it was one round after another of PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, and then the Restaurant Act, and then the Venues Act, trying to respond to the areas affected most. And that's what we're trying to analyze right now, is who's affected most and how do we need in a bipartisan way to step in and help. And I think it is an area where we can get bipartisan support.
All right, Senator Jeff Merkley there from the state of Oregon. Appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today. Be well and Happy New Year as well.
It has been a year now since supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the United States Capitol as Congress gathered there to certify the Electoral College votes from the presidential election. The repercussions of that day still playing out in our courts, in the markets, in the psyche of the American people. Let's take a quick look back at what happened and how it unfolded on that day.
We came here to protect our republic. Walmart! Walmart!
Country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong. We have come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors who have been lawfully slated.
I rise up for myself and 60 of my colleagues to object to the counting of the electoral ballots from Arizona.
Are barricaded. Glass has been broken into the gallery door. Members on the floor have been evacuated. Others are waiting for Capitol Police and sheltering in place. Members are praying.
They broke the glass?
We're all locked down in our offices. I am sickened beyond belief. I can't believe that it is happening in the capital of the United States of America.
You need to take that scarf to be with us.
Go shoot some more Americans.
Hey.
Senate will come to order. Today was a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. May God bless the United States of America. Let's get back to work.
One of the members of Congress who was evacuated from the chamber that day was Representative Jerry Connolly, a Democrat of Virginia. And the congressman is joining us now. Congressman, thank you so much for being here. I know that these are painful memories to have to relive here today, but it's an important conversation, obviously, to have here. So as you watch that footage and as you think back a year ago, what do you think is now most important for Americans to remember and most important for Congress to achieve in the wake of those events?
I think Americans need to understand the importance of January 6th. It was not just an isolated group of people who got carried away. This was a deliberate assault on the functioning of democracy, the most sacred function of democracy, as a matter of fact, the counting of the ballots of a free and fair election and certifying the results and the peaceful transfer of power. All of that was challenged that day, aided and abetted and incited by the then president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, who ironically encouraged the mob to descend on the US Capitol to protest what was happening, while he, of course, saying we're going to walk to the Capitol, promptly went back to the safety of the White House, where he watched the violence, apparently with pleasure, on television.
Congressman, what do you believe is the longer term impact of the insurrection in this country?
The question, I think, for Americans is, will we abide by the results of free and fair elections, or are we going to participate in corrupting the process by undermining it through voter suppression, by stacking electoral boards that will challenge actual voting tallies, by trying to make it impossible to certify legitimate election results when Congress convenes in joint session to certify the next president? Do we believe in democracy or not? Are we committed to democracy or not? And are we going to normalize violence as part of our polity going forward? That's a very, very fraught road to go down. And I think January 6th really encapsulated all of those issues for us. They're still with us, unfortunately. We haven't resolved them. And so, that struggle continues. And those of us who voted to certify the election and were willing to stay in the House to see it done a year ago today, are still fighting that battle. And we're going to continue to fight it for the sake of democracy, for the sake of future generations of Americans. And my hope is that those generations will look back on this time period and say, thank God there were people willing to stand up for what was right. People like Liz Cheney, a very courageous Republican, a conservative, the daughter of one of the most conservative vice presidents in the history of the country. But she has stood up for what was right, and she's spoken out about it as speaking truth to power in her own party. We need a lot more Liz Cheneys in America.
And of course, the president also spoke about it today, right? President Biden giving quite a forceful speech an hour ago is when he was wrapping up that speech, not naming Donald Trump by name, but referring to him multiple times as the former president, in fact, the defeated former president, as he put it. What is it, as we hear that combative tone and as we hear you talking about the fight that we now need to have, what does that fight look like? You know, is it a new Voting Rights Act? What needs to happen sort of state by state to ensure that fair and free elections continue?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I welcome and applaud President Biden's remarks today. They were forceful. They were unequivocal. They laid out the issues with great clarity, and he showed enormous fortitude in helping people understand what the stakes are. As we move forward, I think we have to be as aggressive as possible in prosecuting those who perpetrated the violence on January 6th, in pursuing the truth of how did that happen and who's responsible for it, no matter how high it goes, in going after extremist violent groups in America who for far too long were allowed with impunity to operate in social media in broad daylight in terms of what their agenda was and what they were up to, which was the violent overthrow of our former government. And I think we have to fight back with voter suppression by passing the two voting rights bills that are before the Senate right now that have already passed the House. Whatever it takes. I mean, if we have to get rid of the filibuster to do it, what's more sacred in our democracy than the ability to vote and have that vote counted? We fought too long and too hard through the civil rights movement, through women's suffrage, to go back. And we can't allow ourselves to go back. And we have to make sure that we're fighting the good fight at the state and local level so that insurrectionists and white supremacists and Trump's extreme elements of the far right aren't taking over electoral boards to actually undermine and decertify actual votes that were counted. And that is a process that's going on as we speak, and we have to fight back.
I was going to ask you about that specifically, because there was a recent report by NPR that talked about various Republicans who disputed the outcome of the election now attempting to be Secretary of State, for example, people who are in a position of power when it comes to certifying those election results. Talk to me about the awareness within the party about those challenges and how systemic the efforts are. What are the efforts in order to try to prevent that from happening?
I would hope that I think there is a level of awareness, but I would hope that my fellow Democrats move that level of awareness to a level of deep, deep alarm and action. We cannot stand by and allow legislative niceties like the filibuster and the role of protecting the filibuster to actually prevent us from passing pivotal, critical legislation to protect the right of everyone to cast their vote and have it counted. The stakes are absolute and enormous, and this is the moment we can actually turn that tide. And if we miss this moment, we'll be looking back in this period of time about what a tragic missed opportunity we experienced. So I would hope that in my own party, we understand that the stakes are so high and action is called for right now.
Congressman, thank you so much for being here and sharing your thoughts on this important milestone day. Representative Jerry Connolly, Democrat of Virginia. Thanks again.
Well, we are just a few days into 2022, and already I think it might be worth looking at what's to come, because it sometimes feels like in the pandemic that time is lost. And it's hard to keep track of exactly what is important to watch. But luckily for us, a list of the top stories to watch here in 2022, including the likes of watching the boycott shaping up at the Olympics in China and the explosion of central bank digital currencies now floated at multiple central banks around the world. And for more on that, I want to bring on Josh Lipsky, Atlantic Council Geoeconomic Center Director, here with us with a closer look at what made your list, Josh. And I guess we can start with kind of what's du jour today when we're talking about the Fed and their three interest rate hikes planned for 2022. And you're in the camp, too, that it might be tough to get there given kind of the growth slowdown we're expected to see.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the Fed is what's on everyone's mind right now. Of course, what we heard in December, penciling in the 3 rate hikes, and then the minutes that came out yesterday. I think that's ambitious, 3 rate hikes. And I wouldn't say that that's even my base case of where things are. And a lot of people have made the arguments as to why Omicron, other issues, inflation maybe coming down a bit. But I look at the history. If you go back 30 years when rate hike regimes have begun, whether under Greenspan or under Yellen, the economy has been accelerating from the previous quarter. That's not going to be the case in Q1 2022 compared to Q4 2021. We're actually going to be decelerating. We're going to have moderating growth in 2022 compared to the rebound year in 2021. So just from a historical perspective, what the Fed is then saying is that they're going to hike 3 times into an actual slowdown, still growth, but slower growth than the year before. And that's why I think they're going to have that first rate hike, the one that says, hey, we're serious, we mean it. But the other two are very much a question mark for me at this point.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you highlight that risk, Josh, in terms of a potential slip up with the timing of these rate hikes. The Fed, of course, not the only major central bank that's looking to tighten and hike. We're looking over in Europe as well with the ECB. When you look at all the major central banks, what does that tightening cycle ultimately mean for expectations of global growth in the year ahead?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we've had these sort of global easing cycles. I'm not sure that this is going to be a unified global tightening cycle. It's going to be very fractured. The ECB has said, and Christine Lagarde have said, that they're going to move much more slowly on tightening than the Fed. I think you saw that sort of division emerging in December, and I think you'll see it even more clearly in February and March. And so you're going to see the growth picture follow that different easing cycle picture, and it's not going to be this unified rebound we saw in 2021. It's actually going to be very different compared to Asia, Europe to the US.
Well, let's stick with central banks too, though, because as you've kind of been doing a great job tracking the rise of all of them, trying to figure out cryptocurrency, watching the rise of that and saying, hey, look, we should probably get on this ourselves. And so, of course, we've been tracking the Fed in what they've been trying to do, China unveiling their own as well around the Olympics. So what are you seeing there in terms of how they're trying to tap into that growth too?
Well, this is one of, I think, the most important stories for 2022. Money is going virtual. And this is not just a China story. And this is not just a cryptocurrency story. This is a central bank story. There are now 90 central banks representing 94% of the global economy interested in developing a central bank digital currency. And if you think of the big 4 central banks, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the Fed is unfortunately the furthest behind of those 4. And there are models proliferating all over the world. South Korea is now pursuing a pilot that uses distributed ledger technology. The Riksbank, the oldest central bank in the world, has a pilot program. And so people are going to change the way they interact with their governments and interact with finance in 2022. And I'm not sure we fully process that in the US because we're unfortunately lagging behind.
Yeah, and certainly it's not just a China story, but we've talked so much about them because they have been the leaders in this space. We saw just today, or I think yesterday, WeChat now supporting the digital yuan. We're talking about 800 million monthly active users in WeChat Pay alone. How does that accelerate things for China as they look ahead to really give the global rollout come Beijing Olympics?
Yeah, this is going to be the coming out party for the digital yuan in early February at the Beijing Olympics. Already, we know 10% of the citizens of China have opened up e-yuan wallets. And now with the app more widely available, it'll probably scale up to 20 or 25% within the next 6 to 8 weeks. That is massive growth in terms of hundreds of millions of users. But remember, this is a domestic only product right now. This can only be used internally in China. And the question coming out of the Olympics with these international athletes coming, will they use it? Will they be able to use it? We believe you can open it with just your passport number. And then what happens on the back end? Can you take it back home? Of course, right now, the answer is no. But are the Chinese officials and the People's Bank trying to figure out a way to make this cross-border? And if you look what we track at the Atlantic Council around the world, the cross-border testing of digital currencies is really a fascinating story for 2022. And again, not just China, but Australia is doing it. South Africa is doing it. Countries are partnering and learning with each other. And again, the U.S. is not in that game right now.
On the issue of China, you've highlighted this growing divide that we're seeing between how governments view the risk in China versus how businesses do. And you've highlighted the fact that those sponsors have stuck around for the Beijing Olympics, names like Airbnb as well as Intel. They haven't necessarily spoken out against China's human rights abuses. But I wonder if you think businesses can continue to operate under this assumption that the market and the growth opportunity there is going to sort of dictate where they move and how they move in China, when we're continuing to see the blowback from consumers, especially in China, become more significant.
Yeah, it's such a great point that I think this disconnect is not really realized. You know, we talked about 30% of the world by GDP doing a diplomatic boycott of the Olympics, but 0% of the world's major companies who are the top sponsors of the Olympics boycotting. And look at what Tesla did just the other week in terms of opening up the showroom there. So companies aren't feeling the pain right now. But back to the digital currency conversation, think about this as a company trying to operate in China. Imagine that you now have to accept digital yuan. And imagine at some point the Chinese authorities become cross with you because of something you said back home about what's happening in Xinjiang, for example. They would now have a shutoff mechanism available to you very quickly to make sure no payments could be made in country to your company. And so the warning to multinationals is be aware. Be aware of the risk you're taking on operating here. And yes, there's profits to be made. We all understand that. And there may not be a price to pay immediately, but that doesn't mean there won't be a price to pay in the medium term.
Yeah, and Josh, the other one too, that is interesting, and China's a good example of this, all roads seemingly leading back to China when it comes to the top stories to watch, and maybe that's been the case for a while. But when we look at data privacy, and really, I guess, the story around that, shoring up and maybe making sure that some of their data doesn't leave the country, we've seen some other countries pursuing the same kind of policies. I mean, how important is data going to be, maybe not just in 2022, but years beyond? And I do wonder if maybe crypto comes into that when we think about how maybe users can start profiting, or dare I say, controlling a bit more of their data. There have been some interesting innovations there too.
Yeah, you know, there's two ways to think about it, because one is we've all been experiencing this real-time data revolution in macroeconomics over the past 18 months in the pandemic. How are people spending their money right now? Open table reservations, just as one sort of economic indicator we weren't thinking about as much 2 years ago. But China's thinking about shutting some of that down. We've been tracking their ships. That's been important for our understanding of supply chain crunches. They don't want that anymore. They don't want to share that information anymore. And they're not the only ones. There are similar laws, data privacy laws, across Southeast Asia now. And I think that's a real warning sign for folks who have been relying on that kind of information and basing their models on that kind of information. Countries are no longer comfortable sharing it. That's going to be a change in the way we operate and forecast in 2022. And then on the digital currency front, if we know, if central banks know how people are spending their money, and that's one of the opportunities with central bank digital currency, that's real-time data as well. If you understand the macro trends happening within your economy and how money is getting spent, there's a tremendous opportunity there, but privacy has to be protected. That's why the Western countries are so far behind in this conversation, and countries like China haven't worried about that as much in their rollout.
Josh Lipsky, Atlantic Council Geoeconomic Center Director. Appreciate you coming on, man. All fascinating things and a lot, really, to focus in on in 2022. Thanks again.
Constellation Brands dropped a better-than-expected earnings report this week on the back of top-selling beer brands Corona and Modelo. But the company did warn beer margins are being weighed down a touch by supply chain disruptions. Worth noting, though, Constellation did lift its full-year sales outlooks for its beer and wine businesses. Let's check in with Constellation Brands President and CEO Bill Newlands. Bill, always nice to see you. Happy Friday. Let's put a hold on touching on earnings for a second here. You signed a new deal with Coca-Cola, and you will bring to market an alcoholic Fresca. My question to you, out of all the drinks in Coke's portfolio, why Fresca?
Fresca, for us, Brian, did a couple of things. First of all, it fits in with a lot of consumer trends. It's refreshing, it's convenient, it's low-cal, obviously. And we were surprised that over 50% of Fresca drinkers already mix it with alcohol beverages. So it seemed like a natural to be able to bring that to market in a ready-to-serve. And by the way, Fresca is the chief growth driver, the number one growth driver relative to the relative to the low-cal sodas in their portfolio. So it would seem like a natural for us.
And Bill, we were joking a bit about my trip at a hotel earlier in the week. In the hotel bar, they had there was an explosion of ready-made cocktails. They had espresso or alcoholic espresso in a can. I'm surprised by this explosion, but is that the next frontier for beverage makers like you, these ready-to-drink, on-the-go cocktails?
Ready-to-drinks have been a very hot sector. Part of it is it's that convenience factor of being able to get it directly. You know, we've done that with our High West brand, bringing out Manhattans and Old Fashions in a ready-to-drink format, because a lot of consumers are looking for that convenience and speed today that a ready-to-drink can provide.
Hey, Bill, it's Julie here. At the same time, you know, sort of following these kinds of trends can be risky, right? As you and others in the industry found out when we saw the hard seltzer boom and then crash in a very sort of short period of time. I shouldn't say crash. There, you know, people still are buying these things. And so I'm just wondering, as you kind of make the calculus for getting into a new category in a more decided fashion, how you kind of weigh that, you know, trying to stay abreast of trends while at the same time not betting the farm on stuff?
Sure. Julie, one of the things that we think about is the importance of brand. We talked about Fresca. It's a well-known brand. It's got great growth profile. I think the more that you get into some of these ready-to-serve categories, the consumer's looking for brands that they know and trust. And then obviously you have to put a great product in the bottle. But that's something that we view as very important is making sure you're using brands that are trusted by the consumer. It's a great example of why our Corona Extra business has done extremely well. In an environment where people are concerned about trust, some of those iconic brands like Corona Extra have done very well.
Bill, in my recent trips to the supermarkets, I've seen a pick back up in out of stocks on the shelves in many categories. I would venture because the Omicron variant. Are you seeing consumers hoard products again like alcohol?
It's a little early to tell on that. Obviously, the holiday season is a big season for consumption anyway. But we're beginning to see, at least in our business, getting our inventory levels back to the spot where we'd like to see them. So I think it's an open question. What has changed a lot is how the consumer buys. You're seeing a lot more three-tier e-commerce and people doing click and collect and things of that nature, so that there's less high touch than there was back when we all just moseyed into a store and bought what we wanted.
Bill, brown glass is a problematic area for you guys apparently now. You're seeing rising prices for brown glass, which things like Modelo go into. And so there was some commentary on your conference call that you're going to have to raise prices more than you typically do, in part because of that. Can you give us a little more color on that, a little more detail on that, by how much prices are going up and for which items?
We look at pricing on a market-by-market, SKU-by-SKU basis. And our general way of approaching it is roughly 1% to 2% growth annually. We were a little ahead of that this past calendar year. We'll probably be a shade ahead of that this coming year because some of the cost challenges we have. But we're very judicious and careful. We have an algorithm that we work from, and we're very careful to make sure that we're not losing the consumer as we enhance our pricing position.
Bill, some food makers, Conagra, first and foremost this week, has been talking a lot about absenteeism in their facilities because of the variant. Are you seeing worker shortages in your own plants?
We haven't significantly. One of the things that we're particularly proud about is the work that our team in Mexico has done. You know, more than half our population is based in Mexico. And we have in excess of 95% vaccination rate. It's spectacular. And it's allowed us to not only keep our people safe, but also continue to supply the product that consumers want.
Interesting. Last but not least, we're getting a user question in for you here, Bill. Dry January, it's in full effect. Does that impact your business?
Not a whole lot. I think people are always careful about what they do at certain times of the year. But, you know, one of the things you have is when people choose to do something a little less, they still engage with those brands that are trusted. And certainly Our December results were way ahead of what we had expected them to be and ahead of our year-to-date trends. And I think that we're going to see a very strong January and February as we close out our fiscal year. So it hasn't been a big issue for us. And I think it's largely around the kind of iconic brands that we bring to the market.
Well, I can tell you this. My Friday is ending with a Corona premiere. We'll leave it there. Constellation Brands President and CEO Bill Newlands, always good to see you. Have a good weekend.